Nighttime on Still Waters. This is NB506812, narrowcasting into the night from somewhere on Britain's waterways. March 7th, Thursday. A grey wind blows from a grey sky, troubling the surface of the canal. Damson blossom, torn from branch, spun snow-like with each gust. Sweet smell of wood smoke and the throat catch of coal crosses my path head high and is lost along the canal. There's a Frieda. This is Swami. That passed over. So may this. Tonight is the night of a new moon, but heavy clouds blanket the dark skies and an easterly wind furrows the water's surface. Besides, it'll not rise before daybreak tomorrow. So for tonight, we make do with a darkness that you can almost touch with your hand. This is the Narrowboat Erica, narrowcasting into a mad March, spring-touched night, to you, wherever you are. You made it. Thank you for coming. I was hoping you'd be here. Step aboard and come inside. There's a seat saved for you and the kettle has boiled, so take the weight off your feet and welcome aboard. The lengthening days continue their stride. Most walks can now be completed without the aid of torchlight, for we're now not too far away from the vernal equinox, the balance of daylight and night. A time when, in the UK, the sun rises and sets due east and west at very nearly 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. Well, for this latitude, it's more like 6:15 a.m. and p.m. And so far, March has certainly been living up to its Anglo-Saxon name, Clwyda month, the loud or noisy month. Eleanor Parker, in her book Winters of the World, quotes the Menologium, an ancient poem about the cycle of the year that appears in a manuscript of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Adorned with frost, with hail showers, fierce March journeys through the earth, loud voice, Clwyda. The Anglo-Saxons also had another name for this month, and sometimes called it Lengthenmonath, to mark the lengthening of the daylight. It's where it's thought that the word Lent within the Christian calendar most probably derives. Both names have been very much in evidence this year. And our old friend and guide to the seasons, Miles Hadfield, notes that Romulus, the founder of Rome, placed this month as first in his calendar. And until 1752, it closed and opened our own legal year. This association of March with newness is also reflected in Chaucer's The Nun's Tale, where we are told, when that same month wherein the world began, which is called March, wherein God first made man. And some days this week, along the canal, it does seem to be a time of newness. The air warm and soft blurred with minute insect wings, and lambs appearing in the emerald counterpane of adjacent fields, tottering with spindly knock-kneed legs on the still spongy soil. And blackthorn blossom is just about to burst, tiny polystyrene pills still tinted green that are getting ready to unfurl. And mint-green elder leaves are beginning to spiral out of their buds. Happy times for squirrels. New-growth grass is starred with the warmth of dandelion yellow coltsfoot and a sprinkling of forget-me-not blue. Couch and nettle, sword spears of sedge, frilly cow parsley and trowel-shaped cuckoo pint, large and glossy, all lighting Dylan Thomas's green fuse of spring. I have to admit, a little recognition of my green age at the moment. And above our heads, rooks and crows gaggle and spar with buzzards, kestrels and kites. This time in earnest and no quarter is given in that scolded clamouring air. And the small wood copse and the hedgerows blossom with spring song. However, other days lie heavy and forlorn, wrapped in the damp wool of mist. The cold world drips. The fields and the towpath present a battered and threadbare look. Litter, broken twigs, branches knotted in barbed wire, torn stretches of glutinous mud. And on those days, Maggie and I lope along on our walks, silent in our own worlds, picking our way through the all-too-evident debris of winter and storm. A pale sun glows coldly from an indifferent sky that seems to not care a fig for the coming of spring and light. "March blow by with your stormy grey eye," wrote Eleanor Fargeon. It's a good couplet for this March tide. But the brown and the silver greys are being replaced by the green and blues. The wheels are turning. A.E. Houseman's words still ring true. Braver notes the stormcock sings to start the rusted wheel of things. And this year, through my eye, the turning wheel does seem to feel a little rusty and stuck. But I too have heard the missile thrush expand his repertoire of riffs and musical volleys, and there's no denying the power of it. And for all its noise-fierce cludamonth, there is a warmth in the sun, and softer light dances upon the stirred waters. And even though for me at the moment I don't seem to find much energy for either, I'm content to be carried with the tide this time. This wave will bear my weight. And there are times to be carried. Spring does not need my help or constant commentary. And it's good to step back, just be reminded of the fact. And perhaps these days are best summed up by the observations of John Clare, that self-taught peasant poet, though he rightly riled against that title, in his The Last of March, written at Lolham Briggs. Though o'er the darksome northern hill, old ambushed winter frowning flies, and faintly drifts his threatening still in snowy, sweet, and blackening skies. Yet here the willow leaning lies and shields beneath the budding flower where banks to break the wind arise. 'Tis sweet to sit and spend an hour. I have really appreciated all the comments and emails that you sent in, particularly following last week's episode. And once again, I've not been able to reply as quite as speedily as I'd want, but please know that I do read them all, and I appreciate the warmth and the encouragement and the wisdom of your words and thoughts. So thank you. And a special thank you to Dana Reed. Dan, it was so lovely to hear from you, and thank you for your lovely words. And Alistair, sorry to hear about your loss. And to Tracy Thomas, and Captain Arlo, and to Chris and Alan. And thank you, Carol Sargent. I loved your email, and it wasn't rambling at all. And yes, it is important that we can find outlets to talk through these wide mixture of emotions that these times bring, and I hope all goes well with your particular situation. And also thanks to Lee for sending over some wonderful videos of the local sights and sounds. Lee, The cranes were absolutely spectacular, and I've watched it a number of times and no doubt more times to come, so thank you. And thank you and hello to Joe and to LJ with Bodhi and Jason and Archie Piplow on Facebook and Hannon Cohen and Anna McKellar and Masterton and Liz on X. Thank you so much for the retreat or whatever it's called now, Liz. And finally on Spotify, it was lovely to hear from you, Chris Hines, and thank you so much for leaving such a lovely comment. I forget that on some of the platforms that you can now add comments, and adding comments or just clicking on the like does apparently help to lift the profile of the podcast in the algorithms. I haven't really got much time for all of that, the chasing of ratings and everything, but I am told that it's important. So thank you if you do that. And, of course, a very big thank you to all of our Lockwheelers for supporting this podcast. They are Chris and Alan on the narrowboat, The Land of Green Ginger, Captain Arlo, Rebecca Russell, Alison on the narrowboat, Mucker, Derek and Pauline Watts, Anna V, Orange Cookie, Donna Kelly, Mary Keane, Tony Rutherford, Arabella Holtzapfel, Rory, with MJ and Kayla, Narrowboat Precious Jet, Linda Reynolds Birkins, Richard Noble, Carol Ferguson, Tracy Thomas, Mark and Tricia Stowe, and Madeline Smith. Thank you. One of our longtime listeners, Lee Thomas, who lives high up in the still snowy Colorado mountains, recently asked me a couple of really good questions, and I thought that they might be of interest to others too. So I'm going to answer her second question first. So it sort of fits with a question that Jason asked quite a few months ago, and I nearly answered it at the end of last year, but I ran out of time. And I'm aiming to answer Lee's other question in a week or so's time. So, first of all, Lee wrote, "We are, of course, in the deepest depths of winter here at 8,000 feet. But I see from the various canal vlogs I follow that not only canals, but water points periodically freeze in winter, even there in relatively balmy England. It seems that you and most other narrowboaters heat your boats almost exclusively with your solid fuel stoves, just as I heat my little house stroke cabin, almost exclusively with a wood stove. I have a single unit, natural gas stove in the central living area, and in winter have taken to plugging in an electric radiator in the bathroom where most of the plumbing is. But when it gets seriously cold, like last month when it got down to minus 17 degrees Fahrenheit one night, I still had a pipe freeze, although fortunately I was able to thaw it with a hairdryer and it wasn't damaged. If the electricity went out during a significant cold spell, I would have to set an alarm and get up a couple of times a night to feed the wood stove fire, as the stove is not big enough to hold a fire all night and is not rated for coal. Even then, I might end up with frozen pipes. For this reason, I'm very reluctant to leave my house for more than a few days in the winter." And Lee, knowing that recently we've had to leave the boat, asked, "How do we cope?" And it's a really good question. And it's often stated, and I think I've done it here, that there's a joke amongst boaters that invariably the very first question that is being asked about living aboard a boat is, "Gosh, isn't it cold in winter?" To which the standard answer is invariably, "No, far from it. We're usually much warmer and cozier than we would be if we were living in a house." And while that is true, I just want to push back on the answer a little, as it can be a little bit misleading. Boats in winter are not naturally warm places, like, say, a cave or a house built underground. In other words, you do have to work at keeping them warm. And while it's true that it is far easier and quicker to warm and maintain the heat of a 60-foot by 7-foot by 7-foot tube than, say, a house, left to themselves, boats can become really cold and damp places and will settle down to perhaps a few degrees above the ambient outside temperature. A few weeks ago, we had a couple of nights of minus 10 degrees centigrade. That's about 14 degrees Fahrenheit. And a couple of our friends nearby who had to leave their boat to attend a funeral elsewhere in the country returned to find everything frozen solid, including the water in their dog's bowl. So it's not just cold, but also damp, which can mean that all the furnishing and bedding can feel rather cold and clammy. So this could create a problem if leaving a boat unattended in the winter. As Lee notices, mainly boats use solid fuel stoves to keep warm. And for the winter, our main source of heat is our solid fuel stove that's located in the bow end of the boat. And this is normally more than enough to keep us very warm and cozy. And we've now learnt its foibles enough to be able to bank it up and damp it down so that it lasts right the way through the night. And it means that if we need to be out during the day, we can also safely leave it alight. We do also have a smaller stove in the stern, here in the study where I do the recordings for this podcast. But this is really only lit when it's extremely cold. Otherwise, it just gets too hot. And this way, we can keep more than just warm during the coldest days and nights of winter, but also feeling really snug and cozy. And because of the nature of boat design, and one of the things that I like about them most is that you're physically much closer to the elements outside. And this can mean that you can encounter what at first might feel a bit strange. For example, on very cold nights, even though it may feel pleasantly warm in the boat, it can be quite common to wake up with ice on the inside of the windows, particularly the bedroom ones, which tends within the Erika to be the coldest area. Or no, I should say coolest rather than coldest. It's not cold. And actually, I quite like lying in bed and feeling the stickiness of the frost on the window pane just above my head. It reminds me of when I was a lad and huffing at ice ferns that swirled icily across my bedroom window. However, as Lee's question suggests, using this form of heating is not possible if, like us recently, we have to be away from the boat for a couple of days. Fortunately, we also have a diesel-powered central heating system. Normally, we tend to use this only in spring and autumn when it's too warm to warrant the stove being lit, but you just need something to keep the chill of night at bay. And we also use it as a frost guard with the thermostat turned right down. This is to ensure that the boat does not get below freezing. And this is especially useful for those times when we do have to leave the boat overnight and therefore can't rely on or use the stoves. And this is more than enough to avoid the pipes freezing or returning to a boat that feels a little bit cold and damp. But the problem came this year, when we've actually had to leave the boat more than we normally do. And again, although the heater is usually really reliable, it developed a fault and we haven't been able to use it for a while. Now, fortunately, the temperatures haven't been too bad, but on a couple of occasions when the forecast suggested that the temperatures would dip below zero, we did take the added precautions of draining all the water from the water supply system, just really for our peace of mind. It does still mean that there are some vulnerable pipes, but the main ones are covered and are inside the boat. And the other relatively exposed area would be the engine bay. And the problem with chatting to experienced boaters about winter hazards is that you hear all sorts of nightmare stories, like engine blocks splitting and things like that. And the first winter we bought the Erika and before we moved aboard, I lived totally on tenterhooks, devouring each weather bulletin and forecast and imagining all sorts of horrendous things happening while we were away. I've never drained an engine or fully drained the water tank, something I'm a little bit loath to do as it's 20 years old. It has sediment, and stirring it all up and then dragging that through the pumps is not something that I would want to do, and so therefore could cause more problems than we're trying to avoid. So living aboard with the heating on keeps all of these exposed areas above freezing anyway, so it's not too much of a problem. And if we were to have some significantly low temperatures, the type that Lee encounters, I think I would simply, like her, really avoid leaving, and we'd stay on the boat for exactly the same reasons as Lee. Small electric heaters can be an option. However, most boaters tend not to use them, as they can just gobble up electricity, and consequently, that means you're constantly keeping an eye on the battery levels. And if you're on a landline hookup, I guess it's not so bad. And I know of a few boaters who do keep small electric heaters for emergencies. However, generally, they're not usually seen as a viable option, particularly if you're on the move. And while we don't have anywhere near those extreme temperatures that Lee describes, it is for this reason that normally we try to avoid being away from the boat for extended periods during the colder periods of winter. So I think, Lee, apart from our considerably milder climate, as for dealing with cold weather, we have a lot in common. However, perhaps it's a little bit easier for us in that our smaller size makes things a bit more manageable, and the boat design means that most of the vulnerable pipework is inside the living space and therefore benefits from being inside a insulated warm cabin. But like you, leaving the boat unoccupied in severe cold can pose particular challenges. But thank you for that question. And now to the other one, which is in some senses also about life aboard, but from the aspect of buying a boat. And it comes from another of our longtime listeners, Jason Polite, who lives over in Arkansas. Jason and Karen are coming over to the UK. If I remember rightly, it's around Easter time, so it's not actually too far away now, Jason. And they're going to be hiring a narrowboat for a cruise. So, Jason and Karen, first of all, I apologize for that. This has taken such a long time to answer it. So thank you for being patient. And Jason and Karen asked me about how long does it take to buy a narrow boat? And Jason, yes, as you suspected, the short answer really is, yeah, well, that all depends. Now, I know that's probably not going to help you much at all, so I'm going to enlarge on it. And we'll take as my starting point the assumption that you have found the boat that you want to buy. And that is that the time spent trying to find the right boat can take the longest part of this process. In all honesty, I'm not too sure of the current state of play that the market's in now for secondhand and used narrowboats. I know the lead time of buying a brand new narrowboat is in matter of years rather than months. I'm very aware that just after the pandemic, there was a significant shortage of narrowboats on the market. I think that was partly from people reevaluating their lives, and also partly in the upsurge in interest and appreciation of the natural world that began to arise from the lockdowns. Canal walks and nature vlogs are instrumental in highlighting this aspect of canal life. And there's also a plethora of articles and online and in Sunday supplements, as well as a fair few vlogs extolling the joys of life afloat and that it was a cheap alternative or solution to the many woes of the modern world. And consequently, there are loads of people seeking to buy a canal boat, and a narrow boat in particular, which made it very much a seller's market. So boats were being sold almost before they went on the market, and their price was rising alarmingly. And I had friends who were getting extremely frustrated because by the time a boat seemed to go on the market, it was already sold. They were certainly out of our price range at that time. I think the market has now settled down a bit, And I certainly don't come across so many adverts from brokers soliciting potential boat sellers. So having said all of that, it still can take a good few months, maybe a year, before you actually find that boat that you really want. But again, it all depends on what you're looking for and how flexible you are, how open to compromise you are. So that is really one of those unknown variables. But let's assume now that you have found the boat. So how long does it take to purchase it? Well, I suppose technically, if you found a boat, then the process of buying it can be really just a matter of however long it takes you to agree the price and then transfer your money over. So that's probably not the best way of doing it, but it can be done that quickly. In that sense, it can be a little bit like buying a car. You check it over, kick the proverbial tires, which in this case is peering into the engine bay, giving it a test run, looking over for signs of wear and tear, then putting in an offer if you want to haggle a bit, and then transfer the money. There's no logbook as such, so do get an appropriate declaration that she is now your property. Register and license the boat in your name with the CRT, sort out the insurance. Actually, I don't think you can get a license if it's not insured. I could be wrong on that. And you could do it, if all the ducks line up, pretty much in one day. Now, as I say, that is one way of approaching it. However, I would recommend that rather than approaching it as if you were buying a car, that you would approach it much more as if you were buying a house, particularly if you're going to be living on it. This offers you far more protection. But it also does mean that the process can take a fair bit longer. This is because you will need to contact a surveyor and get a full survey done on the boat. And I would really, really recommend you do that. Not just a quick survey, but they'll go for the full one. Again, it costs more. It will take longer, but it gives you peace of mind. You do know then much more about what you are actually buying. So to take the analogy of that you're buying a house, it's a house that not only has an engine, which is important, but more importantly, it's a house with large sections of which is going to be hidden from you because it's going to be underwater. Therefore, always go for a full survey that includes lifting the boat out of the water or taking it to a dry dock for a complete inspection and survey of the hull, as well as the rest of the boat. So that would be the electrics, gas, if it's equipped with it, and other important structural components. As I say, this does slow the process down. And again, that is dependent on a number of different factors. But generally here, and I've got my fingers crossed behind my back when I say it, is think about it as about a month, perhaps a little bit more. The surveyor's report will give you much more information about any work that needs to be carried out. And so it makes sense to wait until it's done before you put in your firm final offers. The other factor is that it does cost money. And one of the things that we were particularly concerned about was this fear that if you do get a survey that does show that there was something significantly wrong with the boat, and so therefore you decide not to go ahead with its purchase, and this happens a couple of times, that we would be seeing that our pot of money that we had put aside to buy the boat begin to drastically dwindle, and therefore placing the type of boat that we needed out of our price range. Now, again, so it's always a bit of a gamble. However, fortunately for us, that didn't happen. But I would say don't let that fear put you off going for a survey. We also brought the Erica through a broker. And from the time that we put down a deposit to effectively take her off the market, where we had the survey done, was, I think, about 3 weeks. And again, this can be subject to a lot of variation. Good surveyors are very busy and therefore get booked up. Also, if you want a full survey, which will include hiring a crane to lift the boat out or hiring a dry dock, that can also entail having to wait for the next available slot during particularly busy periods. However, once you have got the survey, you're then in a position to take the decision about whether or not to proceed with the purchase and put in an offer. And if the survey does throw up any work that needs to be done, this can obviously affect the price that you might be willing to pay for it. And again, if you can, I would recommend that you go through a broker, because this can make things a lot easier for you in negotiating the price. And once the price has been agreed, then the process is pretty simple and quick. And again, if I remember correctly, I think the whole thing from deciding, yes, the Erica is the boat that we would like to purchase, through to owning her was, I think, a little over a month. Again, we were fortunate in that a lot of things did fall into place, and the survey threw up only a couple of things that the seller was more than happy to cover with the cost. So I think, to get back to your question, Jason and Karen, everyone you ask will have a slightly different answer. But for us, the process took a little bit longer than buying a car, but nowhere near as long as buying a house. So I don't know if that is at all helpful to you or not. And with that, this is the Narrowboat Erica signing off for the night and wishing you a very restful and peaceful night. Good night. Temperature outside 8.4 degrees. Inside 22 degrees. Humidity 75%. Dew point 5 degrees. Wind direction east northeast. Wind strength 15 miles per hour. Barometric pressure 993.6, steady. Cloud cover 97%. Cloud ceiling 13,500 feet. Precipitation nil. Moon phase 0.3%, waning crescent. Day length 11 hours 28 minutes. Sunset 18:02. Sky casting 6:32.